Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with two assessments of the dangers posed to our civil liberties by the passage of the National Defence Authorisation Act, the President threatened to veto but now will sign. First, we speak with Scott Horton, who was a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. We'll try to understand why this law that the heads of our military and national security establishment did not want, that the civil liberties community is alarmed about, was not vetoed by the president. Then joining us for a further discussion of this bill that goes much further in militarizing law enforcement than anything the Bush-Cheney administration ever proposed is Azeez Huq, a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is now a professor of law at the University of Chicago. We will examine the objections that civil libertarians and our top military and national security officials have about the bill and how much the compromise language that was sufficient for the president to withdraw his veto leaves open the possibility of a further erosion of the Bill of Rights and a future abuse of power. Then finally, we'll look into what the U.S. intelligence community lost in the capture of a top-secret state-of-the-art drone now in Iranian hands. One of the world's leading experts on mercenaries, robotics, and future warfare, Peter Singer, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative, joins us. We'll discuss how much of a treasure trove the largely intact Sentinel drone will be for the Russians and Chinese and how it ended up on display by Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, where he also writes the No Comment blog. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And yesterday I spoke with Shahid Batar, who's the head of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, about the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 that is now before the Senate. The president previously threatened to veto it. Compromise language is put in to the point where the president apparently will sign it once it passes the Senate. But the impression that I was left with, and so was our audience, is quite alarming, that the Posse Comitatus Act has been overturned and that the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution are in jeopardy. How do you read the current situation?
Well, I'll say that the sponsors of the legislation made clear in the number of statements that they made on the floor and elsewhere that the legislation is intended merely as a restatement of the law as it currently stands. It wasn't designed to change anything. But that being noted, they also advanced their own interpretations of what the current law was and how the current legislation would reinforce that. And one of the issues was, does the president have the power to order the arrest of an American citizen on American soil and have him carted away overseas somewhere and held in a military prison and tried before a military tribunal? And, you know, we have Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and several other senators saying, absolutely, yes, the president has that power and authority. I think that would come as a surprise to justices of the Supreme Court. I mean, as I count their opinions, at least five of the justices flatly said he didn't have that authority, including Antonin Scalia, who rejected that idea. But I think what we're seeing in this legislation is an attempt to chart out a basis for that sort of action. So this statute definitely could be abused in a very aggressive way. And I'd say the concerns that are being raised are raised with good reason, not because anyone thinks that Barack Obama is going to start arresting thousands of political opponents tomorrow and resting his authority on NDAA, but that some president at some point in the future might very well use this legislation and this initiative for that basis. Because the legislation says, essentially, if the president determines that someone is a terrorist acting in cahoots with Al-Qaeda, he can seize him and he can send him away to be held in a military justice system. So it's a unilateral, almost unreviewable decision by the president. And that, if you look back at the writings of Edmund Burke, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, that was described as the very essence of tyranny.
So as bad as that language is, my understanding is that much of this is a compromise, that Lindsey Graham's and the John McCain's and the Buck McKeon's were pushing in one direction, and in the other direction you had General Petraeus at the CIA, Panetta at the Defense Department, Hillary Clinton, President Obama, Brennan at counterterrorism, the Justice Department, National Security, Lisa Monaco, a whole pantheon of the national security establishment was against this. So it sounds like this is as bad as what you just said, that these powers are now vested in the president. How bad were they before this, and how much ambiguity is left?
Well, let's say that there were two major lines of argument against this legislation. And as best I can see, other than the people who sponsored the legislation and voted for it in Congress, nobody supported this legislation. I mean, the entire senior echelons of the national security apparatus said, no, this is stupid legislation or bad legislation. A retired FBI directors like William Sessions, very, very prominent Republican, said it's bad legislation. Generals like Kulak and Hoar said it was bad legislation. Supporting it basically were the actual authors of the legislation. But the attacks were along the lines that it undermined the authority of the president as executive to make decisions on one hand, and on the other hand, that it undermined the civil liberties of American citizens. And the compromise we got at the end was a compromise that shored up the authority of the president, but gave no ground whatsoever on the civil liberties issues. And Barack Obama decided, you shore up my presidential power and I'll sign it, to hell with the civil liberties issues. And that's very disturbing.
So what are then the civil liberties issues that leave us in jeopardy?
The most fundamental power or the most fundamental civil right is the right not to be deprived of your liberty by your government without accountability before courts, that you should be presented with charges and have a right to defend yourself from them. And this legislation takes that away, or nearly takes that away. So, you know, what it gives you is, the right to defend yourself before a military commission. And the U.S. and countries around the world has said that doesn't cut it. That's the fundamental abuse of human rights. Also, when we look at around the world at democratic societies that have been converted into dictatorships or authoritarian regimes, whether Europe between the wars, South Africa, we can look at Latin American examples. I think you could study literally dozens of countries. You'll find in almost every single case, the decision to collapse democracy rested on measures exactly like this, where the civil rights of the citizenry were taken away in favor of an executive's right to detain people or to hold people or imprison people without accountability, or substituting some sort of military system of accountability. So, this is a critical threat to democratic society.
So this is then a double whammy. The national security establishment was against it. The civil libertarians, as I dare not say they're an establishment, but they are doing the Lord's work here in protecting the Bill of Rights. We've all lost here. For what? I mean, why is this thing happening? My understanding is that Bin Laden's been killed and Al-Qaeda is only down to a few hundred people living in caves somewhere in the mountains of Pakistan. What has suddenly brought this upon the national agenda to the point where the president has had to bow to enough pressure to sign this ambiguous bill because of what?
Well, what's brought it on is 10 years of empty political rhetoric in which class after class of congressmen and representatives have been elected with this mantra of national security law, where they're intent on showing that they're stronger and more robust than anyone else. And the latest mantra is that the military system is better. We love the military. We can't criticize the military. Let's put all this on the shoulders of the military. And that's what has driven this measure. Now, the military doesn't want this. People in the Department of Defense I've talked with have told me that Congress needs to remember that it's Department of Defense, not Department of Detentions. It's not a core part of their mission to administer criminal justice or to run prison systems. That's not what they're there for. We have other institutions that do that. So they're really settling a huge unwanted burden on the military. But they're doing this as part of a sort of political game that suggests that this is stronger or more effective than the civilian system. And that's nonsense.
So is this because Lindsey Graham is a former JAG officer? I mean, I'm searching here for a rationale.
I don't think there is one. I think it's because, well, let's just go back to the beginning. You might call this measure the Gitmo Forever bill, because it aims to keep Guantanamo open forever and to provide a new stream of prisoners to be sent there. So I think one major, and frankly, you go back and you look at John McCain's speeches supporting this, and he spends more time attacking Barack Obama's pledge to shut down Guantanamo than he does justifying the legislation. And I think that's psychologically very revealing. The purpose of this legislation is to ensure that Barack Obama cannot fulfill his campaign pledge of closing Guantanamo. I really think that is the essence of it, and that's complete nonsense. And I think what's really shameful is that you had a handful of Democrats vote in support of this legislation.
Well, Scott Horton, again, professor at Columbia Law School and contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, where he also writes the No Comment blog. And I'm calling you because I was so alarmed, and so was the audience, by yesterday's discussion about how much this bill jeopardizes the fundamental liberties of this country in the First and the Fifth and the Sixth Amendment, along with the Posse Comitatus Act that served the country well. And I thought, my God, you know, today it would be front page everywhere. There's nothing in the LA Times about it at all. And there's a page 26 article in the New York Times. So
it's only The Daily Show that's given this top coverage.
Well,
the fake news of a comedy program, which dealt with it in a deadly serious way, I think.
Well, I mean, he's an awfully intelligent and I think insightful fellow, John Stewart. And I guess that's another way of saying how our press have dropped the ball, right?
I think they have. I mean, I think most of them have accepted the view of the sponsors that, oh, this is just a very, very technical measure, nothing for you to be very worried about. And the civil libertarians who raise concerns about this are, you know, are hysterical. I mean, they're just not viewing this in a sober, careful way. But, you know, I think the bottom line is that this bill either confirms or creates unprecedented power in the president. And if a president were to interpret it and realize it and use it the way people like Lindsey Graham proposed, then, you know, it really would be a horrible thing. It would be shattering to civil liberties. Now, we had virtually every major paper in the country post an editorial against this legislation, including the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, Atlanta Constitution Journal, even relatively conservative newspapers opposed it. It got virtually no support in the press, but neither is the press gone out of its way to alert readers about the dangers that the legislation presents.
But you would think, though, that given Petraeus and General Hoare and General Krulak and the former heads of the FBI and the current head of the FBI, who still thinks that this legislation is very flawed because it has bad language and then it has compromised language, Mueller thinks it's going to lead to tremendous ambiguity. If a terrorist is captured, the FBI are going to be there, and then suddenly the military are going to show up too, and they're going to fight over who's going to put this person into custody.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you know, yesterday there was a meeting of the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives at which one of the representatives stood up and read from the Krulak and Hoare editorial and then read a letter that the former FBI director William Sessions had written, very prominent Republican, actually they're all prominent Republicans, in which they ridiculed and heavily attacked this legislation, and a group of members then started saying, why are we voting for this? Why are we supporting this? And the leadership had to quickly try and stamp it out. But I think that reflects exactly what the problem is. I mean, they're voting for legislation without really understanding it and understanding the negative potential that flows from it. So what's going on here is another major step in the militarization of our justice system, which is ridiculous. It's not what the military wants. It's not what any prudent person would want. And it's being done for short-term partisan political reasons. And I think if our Republican friends were to sit down and actually seriously think about what's being done here and read things like what Generals Krulak and Hoar had to say about it, they would pull back from this misstep.
Well, you've just told us, Scott, that at the Republican caucus, I believe also Dick Cheney spoke on behalf of it.
That's right.
So some prominent Republican who you chose not to name read from the editorial by Generals Krulak and Hoar and also articles by Sessions, the Republican former head of the FBI. That wasn't sufficient. The president, at the end of the day, has the bully pulpit, and he threatened the veto. It feels like he didn't want to make sufficient issue out of it neither. You know, Republican leadership obviously, you know, didn't have any answers, but they sort of buffaloed their caucus into line.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think, Ian, we're in a position where if the president had stepped up and said, I veto it, his veto would have been sustained. There have been, since this bill was originally passed, we've had a series of Republicans who voted for it come forward and say, I didn't understand when I voted for it what I was voting for. This is a mistake, and I've changed my mind. It's very, very clear that the president's veto would be sustained at this point, but the president has decided not to do this. And what's his attitude? Ultimately, this is a measure that gives immense power to the president. And I think the people around the president are delighted to have this power vested in the White House. And what we no longer see much of a trace of is the Barack Obama who in 2008 talked about the excesses of presidential power and promised to do something to dial that back. I mean, we've seen hardly a sign of that Barack Obama in the last 2 years.
So, since I'm here at Hollywood, I'm right across the street from Universal Studios as I speak to you, Scott, I see a movie script here that there's somebody that the president doesn't like, and this person is arrested and disappeared. Is that possible?
Absolutely, it's possible. I mean, under this legislation, a presidential determination that someone is a terrorist acting in conjunction with Al-Qaeda or an associated terrorist group, that's all he needs to do to have the person removed and put down in military detention somewhere beyond the borders of the United States. That is effectively disappeared.
So in other words, if Vladimir Putin had this ability, he'd be doing it right away, right?
Yes, he does have this ability.
I mean, he does. Frankly,
he does these things, yes. And that's, I think, one of the differences between American democracy and democracies of other states. I'd say more authoritarian states around the world vest these powers in their executive, and more democratic states do not. And in fact, you know, at the time of our revolution, there was one point on which the founding fathers were very, very clear, and that is you could not give this kind of power alone to the executive. That, you know, the executive was going to propose to do something involving taking the liberty of a citizen or a resident of the country that had to be subject to challenge and review by a court. And that doesn't mean a military tribunal. Military tribunal composed of officers appointed by the president, not applying the same standards that our Constitution envisions.
So just in closing then, Scott Horton, what are citizens to do about this? I'm not as alarmed as I was yesterday because there's compromise in this, but you've made a very strong case that it's in the law, and if Obama decides or is not bent on abusing his powers, his successors might well, and that the people that even voted for it have buyer's remorse already. What's the citizen to do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I go further and say, I don't think Barack Obama would abuse this. If you look at the way he's governed the last 3.5 years, last 3 years, he's actually been pretty cautious in his use of this sort of power. But I think, you know, a future president might very well do that. So what should the citizen do? I mean, the citizen should write his or her congressmen and senators and tell them they're upset about this legislation and they don't support the militarization of the criminal justice system. That should stop. Frankly, you know, our criminal justice system, our constitutional standards are an asset for the country. That's what General Hoar and General Krulak wrote in their editorial. They said this reflects our ideals. It's something we should be proud of. And in fact, it is it's a weapon that the country can use. It's something that helps us in our battle overseas, not something to hide from.
And, of course, as you've pointed out, the military doesn't even want these powers. So the whole thing is really bizarre. I thank you for joining us, Scott.
Great to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, where he also writes the No Comment blog. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and be back in a moment with another opinion on how grave the threat is to our civil liberties.
Prefer to chain my will onto the wings of my instinct and wander around this box. I'm inextricably linked. You know I'm free to make pursuit, to catch some stuff that holds me down, to capture my desires, fashion out a visit crown. You know I'm.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Aziz Huq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Huq.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me back.
And yesterday I spoke with Shahid Bhattar, the head of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and he gave a fairly alarming account of what the president has now agreed not to veto in terms of the military authorization bill. Apparently the president is satisfied with the revisions that have been made, or the compromises. I thought, based upon what Shahid had said to me yesterday, that this would be a front page story today. There's nothing in the LA Times about it at all, and there's a page 26 article in the New York Times about it. So I'm quite puzzled as to whether me and our audience should still be alarmed that the First, the Fifth, and the Sixth Amendment have been shredded by the Congress.
Ian, I think there's a complex story here, and maybe it's helpful to remind your readers about what's really at issue here. What's at issue is whether and how the government can employ military detention instead of the ordinary criminal process that it uses when it detains someone for a long duration. And the difference pertains to all of the rights that you identified. The government might be able to use military detention on the basis of the exercise of First Amendment rights. And when it engages in the detention, it's fairly clear that it doesn't need to give an opportunity to the detained person to defend themselves with the same procedural rigors that are available in the ordinary criminal process. So this is a pretty consequential question. And the National Defense Authorization Act raises the question because it contains two provisions that, on the one hand, describe the scope of when military detention is permissible, and on the other hand, seem to suggest that there are some instances in which military detention is not just permissible, but mandatory. And early versions of that bill seem to extend not just the availability of military detention, but the mandatory nature of its use into the United States to allow the president or the executive branch to detain people without the rigors of due process, even within the United States. And so that's the kind of basic concern. I think that's a real and significant issue. It's a very, very important question of sort of basic entitlements. And I think the reason that the bill, it's still a bill, it's not a law yet, hasn't hit the front pages of the New York Times, as you say, is that it's really ambiguous what effect the bill has on the president's military lockup power. And here it's helpful to know that even today, before the bill is passed, there is case law in at least one federal circuit, which encompasses, I believe, 4 or 5 states, that allows the government to lock up citizens in military detention without using the criminal process. So there's at least a colorable argument that that authority already exists today under existing law. And then it's not entirely clear from the face of the bill whether or how it changes the scope of that authority. The, one of the consequences of the congressional fights over the bill is that the language of both provisions is really quite unclear. And I think that it is quite plausible to say that given the overwhelmingly important constitutional concerns that this area raises of the kind that I just alluded to, one ought to read that ambiguity narrowly. One ought to read the bill narrowly to not extend this this power. And essentially, that's the basis upon which the president has declined to veto the bill. He says, look, you know, you don't need to read these as effectuating massive changes to the law. But of course, that's this president, right? And it may be that down the road we have a president who is more willing to aggressively read ambiguous statutes, and that's going to generate a different outcome.
Well, I'm reminded, Aziz Haq, of the Second Amendment, which I thought was fairly clear. And recently the Supreme Court turned that on its head, where the predicate was ignored and the second part was accepted as the dominant reality. So is that an example of how things can be reinterpreted?
Yeah, it is. It's relatively rare that constitutional language is subject to that kind of dramatic change, although we may see a dramatic change in the reading of what's called the Commerce Clause when the Supreme Court takes up the healthcare case next year. It's reasonably common for there to be pretty radical changes in the interpretation of the language of statutes, either by the executive branch or courts over time. And there's lots and lots of examples of this from really quite important areas. This has happened with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act that starts off being interpreted one way. Courts take it and interpret it a very different way. The executive takes different positions over time. It happens quite famously with the Clean Air Act, which is initially interpreted quite broadly, and then the Reagan administration comes along and says, no, it doesn't mean as much as you think it means. It means something very, very narrow. You saw the same kind of dispute arising over whether the EPA can regulate carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases a couple of years ago. So the idea that there are ambiguous statutes and the idea that the government will radically change its interpretation of an ambiguous statute with changing partisan administrations is actually pretty common. It happens a lot.
So this kind of Talmudic behavior is par for the course then, Aziz Haq. Although,
well, it's very hard to write laws that are entirely clear and that eliminate all possibilities for
ambiguity.
Ambiguity or the exercise of troubling discretion by the government.
But I thought in this case, though, Aziz, given that what's at stake, based upon the interview yesterday with Shahid Bhattar, that the Posse Comitatus Act is out, the First Amendment is up for grabs, the Fifth and the Sixth. Now, if that's the case, then the ambiguity is not appropriate, surely, when there's so much at stake.
I agree on the merits with Shahid Bhattar. I guess I would say that if you cast your mind back to the authorization for the use of military force that was enacted on September the 18th, 2001, if you look closely at the language of that, it's pretty ambiguous. It might be taken to authorize large uses of military force in the continental United States. And it wasn't interpreted that way, by and large, with a couple of important exceptions in the past decade. But just notice that statutory ambiguity has been available for a decade already, right? So it's not this. I think that this new measure in the NDAA is a very bad thing because it deepens that ambiguity and it has this, I think, really pernicious idea that the criminal justice system can't deal with terrorism cases, which is an idea that essentially Republicans in Congress have conjured up post-2008 as a partisan stick to beat President Obama with. They just didn't think of this in the 7 years preceding that. They didn't criticize President Bush for using the criminal justice system in a vast number of cases, right? This is an argument that has almost no factual predicates behind it. It's an argument that is almost entirely partisan. And one of the troubling things about this, the NDAA, is that it gives some credence to it. It gives some, gives some sense that this is not a utterly specious argument.
In terms of the lineup of those who were afraid that the bill went too far, you had Defense Secretary Panetta, CIA Director David Petraeus, FBI Director Mueller, National Intelligence Director James Clapper, White House Advisor to Counterterrorism John Brennan, Department of Justice National Security Head Lisa Monaco, and then you had the President weighing in personally, so did Hillary Clinton, and on the Republican side, it seems that the bill was being pushed by John McCain and Lindsey Graham. Apparently, former Vice President Dick Cheney briefed the Republican caucus on it. When you mentioned earlier that it's really more of a political issue, Aziz Huq, I'm reminded that it was Karl Rove who said that the Republicans deal with terrorism by putting them in Guantanamo, and Democrats want to give terrorists therapy. So that, you think that's kind of an element that's infected this debate?
Well, I think that it's fairly clear and not particularly controversial to say that the Republican Party has run in part on its strong national security credentials, or its putatively strong national security credentials, not just post-2001, but long prior to that. And that one of the claims in terms when election rolls around, the Republican candidates, both for the White House and for Congress, will make is that the national security is better off in the hands of a Republican rather than a Democrat. The problem with making that claim today is that, on the one hand, with the exception of the major Nidal Hassan incident, there haven't been large terrorist attacks in the United States, either under Bush or under Obama. Moreover, whereas President Bush presided over what is arguably a series of very serious policy failures post 9/11, including the escape of bin Laden from Tora Bora, the Iraq War, one can compound the list. By contrast, President Obama presided over what many in the security services see as the successful operation that ended in the death of bin Laden. And so lacking any substantively sound argument that this is an administration that has been that has failed to keep the nation safe. The Republican side has looked around for specious arguments that support its claim to being tougher on national security than the Democrats. One of those specious arguments is the one that animates the NDAA provisions at issue here, which is that how dare the president use Article 3 criminal process, footnote, Article 3 criminal process that President Bush repeatedly and uncontroversially relied upon for 7 years. The other strand of this is the racially or ethnically tinged claims about disloyalty of Muslims, right? Which is an insinuation that's been made about Obama generally, but we see playing out in the hearings run by Representative Peter King to the effect that, well, the Obama administration hasn't dealt with this serious fifth column problem of Muslims in the United States. Right. And we obviously see that in the Park 51 dispute and the like. So I think those two strands are both working and are both parts of the political strategy.
Well, Aziz Haque, politics are one thing, but the law lives on. And it's very concerning to think that maybe there's language in there that was brought about by these partisan influences, and that then the president and others had to weigh in and put in language that kind of checkmated some of that language. And you may end up with ambiguity, which is what the head of the FBI was concerned about. I'm quoting him. The statute lacks clarity with regard to what happens at the time of arrest. You know, so it's a terrorist incident. The FBI shows up and then the military show up and then they have a fight over who takes who into custody.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that the consensus view of the intelligence and security services, a view that I, for this on this occasion, agree with, is that this statute will harm national security interests, and it's harmed national security interests. I think the only explanation an objective observer can give for that is that this was a statute enacted out of partisan motivations. It was enacted as a way of demonstrating that Republicans were tougher than President Obama on terrorism, and it has the consequence of making national security weaker. I don't think that that's anything. It's not terribly unusual, to be quite frank. I think that national security is often a political football, and I think that often the efforts of those who claim to be the toughest on national security have the net effect of weakening national security, because it's not the case. It's just simply not true that winning a conflict of any kind simply involves the maximal use of force. That's just not how any kind of conflict is won.
So, Aziz Haque, if this new statute that's about to be signed into law and was earlier threatened with a veto by the president is bad for national security, the reason I'm calling you is it bad for civil liberties?
Well, I don't think that the Obama administration will. I think it's very unlikely that they will employ the statute in a way that has bad effects. But the problem, as you mentioned, is that statutes stay on the books after partisan arrangements change. And I do think one can look at the statute and see in it what Justice Robert Jackson once called a loaded gun waiting in the folds of the law for someone else to use. So yeah, I do think it's a loaded gun, and I would prefer to live in a world in which, you know, we don't have that kind of booby-trapped statute book or constitution. So yeah, I do think it's a bad thing, but it doesn't need to be the case for it to be a bad thing that the bad consequences arise today or tomorrow. They can arise 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now.
So just in closing, Aziz Haque, perhaps the partisanship is an explanation for what I find rather puzzling, that bin Laden's been killed. There's only a handful of these al-Qaeda people left in the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And suddenly there's a greater terrorism threat than ever, which has to be responded to by diminishing or at least putting in jeopardy the basic liberties of this country?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. You know, and I would further point out that, you know, this is coming from a led sort of caucus that on the Republican side that consistently fails to deal with what is plausibly a much graver strategic threat to the United States, which is global warming, which will have radical impacts and already is having radical impacts upon the security situation in places like South Asia, in places like China, and which we are not dealing with, which we are pretending doesn't exist. And that's, I think, in 30 or 40 years, people will look back and think, good grief, what were they thinking? And I think what they were thinking is they were thinking of, you know, winning the next election by scaring people with bogeymen rather than talking seriously about the interests of the United States.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Aziz Haque.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Peter Singer, a senior fellow and director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution. He served as coordinator of the Obama 08 campaign's Defense Policy Task Force and as a consultant for the United States Department of Defense and FBI. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Singer.
Thanks for having me.
And what do you make of what the Iranians have there on display? I spoke recently with John Pike at globalsecurity.org. He thought it was a fake, a mock-up, because it didn't make any sense that a plane could be shot down or crash and be in that kind of condition. So is it possible that the Iranians, as they say they have, managed to hack into this guidance system and bring this plane down largely intact?
Well, let's break down that question. There's the issue of, one, is it possible they have one of our drones? And then two is, how did they get it? So, you know, what I would push back at the idea that it's not one of ours, that was the storyline maybe a week ago until no one in the Pentagon denied it. So the silence on denying it spoke louder to the fact that over the last couple of days, we've had both the president and the secretary of defense acknowledge it. So I think that part of the ship has sailed. That part of the story is different. Now, the question is, how it was lost. That's where the dispute is right now. We've, you know, said accidental. That's why we don't have it. You know, we lost it in that way. The Iranians have claimed, no. We took it down in some way. We used, in particular, electronic warfare capabilities to take it down. I don't have any kind of, you know, information to answer one way or another. The possibility that it could have been taken down intentionally in some way, shape, or form, it certainly is out there. The Iranians, as of October, got a very sophisticated electronic warfare system from the Russians. That capability is there, too. In the past, we've accidentally jammed our own systems and forced them down. This happened a couple times in Iraq. So that possibility exists. there's also the possibility that we could have lost it in some accidental form. Same things happen. We've had predators accidentally go awry. To earlier this year, there was an American robotic helicopter that was testing out in Maryland and accidentally started flying directly towards D.C. So, you know, that's happened. Now, the idea that it's in such condition that they couldn't have done so, well, again, it assumes that it fell straight from 40,000 feet. Planes come down in a lot of different ways than just dive bombing from 40,000 feet. So, you know, that the way people are pushing that because it's in some kind of decent condition, it couldn't have crashed. Well, guess what? You know, that's not what happens.
Well, obviously, it is something real because the president wouldn't have apologized. I wouldn't have demanded its return, I should say. But my understanding is that, as with the B-2 bomber, the stealth bat wing, flying wing design, which is similar to this 85-foot wingspan Sentinel, that flying those planes requires very complicated algorithm. They're not easy to fly, let alone fly them remotely. Is that your understanding?
Well, really, it goes to this idea of, okay, if they have it, what's the value to them? And first of all, the main value to them, to the Iranians, is propaganda. That is, you know, they've said, oh, in a year, we're going to have 1,000 of these ourselves. Well, no, they don't have that kind of capacity to pull off. What they've gotten is a great news story for the last couple weeks that's changed the discussion from being about their nuclear weapons program in violation of international law, them having a student storm an embassy in violation of international law, to the topic of discussion right now is one of our spying programs. And so, you know, the real value to them is basically rubbing egg in our face with some kind of fairly cheesy videos. The difference, though, is the value to someone else. They're not going to be able to reverse engineer a lot of it. It's more the components they give to a Russia or a China. And here again, it's not the overall system. It's not the idea of cloning the entire system. First, because a lot of the ideas of stealth design in general are already known. You know, you already know them because you can look at something and say, that looks a little bit like a stealth. It's bat wing. It doesn't have a tail. It's not that part that matters. It's the components of it. It's things like the skin, the coatings, the internal avionics, how it deals with its heat signature. More important than that, then the hardware that's on the plane itself is the sensors that it's carrying. In particular, at least in the past, this type of plane, the RQ-170, has carried a very sophisticated type of radar that the Chinese are about a generation behind us on. Now, here again, you know, it's the difference between hardware and software. Getting the hardware is valuable if you want to reverse engineer it, even if it's damaged in some way, shape, or form. But it's not the complete equation. You still need to understand the software. You know, think about your iPhone. Companies, you know, Apple came out with the iPhone. Companies were inspired by its design. They've done knockoffs in that way. But the key to your iPhone is not just the way it looks. It's the way it operates, which, you know, it's not been easy for other companies to knock off. It's the very same thing here with this system, but, you know, let's do the counterfactual. If someone's trying to build their own either advanced radar or advanced stealth drone, it's a heck of a lot easier to try to do it if you've got a model in front of you, even if it's a damaged model, than not having that model.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Singer, who's a senior fellow and director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution. He served as coordinator of the Obama 08 campaign's Defense Policy Task Force and as a consultant for the United States Department of Defense and the FBI. So the AESA, Active Electronically Scanned Array Radar, that you just referred to, Peter, that's in our most advanced fighters like the F-22 and the F-35. Apparently, they allow a stealthy plane to use its radar, because if you turn on a radar, it's like a flashlight in the dark. It's, so that sounds like, on the surface, if it had that, that'd be very valuable, wouldn't it? to the Russians or the Chinese?
It's one of these key systems that defines what we call fifth generation fighters, the new type of stealthy high performance fighters. Now, let me be clear. In the past, RQ-170 has carried one of these. It's unclear whether it had it on this mission. And then secondly, it's unclear how damaged it was, because you'll notice in the famous pictures that have come out of this drone, the bottom of it has been covered up. And the bottom of it is covered up such that we can't see how much damage happened to it, which is where the sensors are mounted. That even if, the components, it isn't that they're smashed in, they've been bolted off of it. We just don't know that yet. But here again, if you're thinking about what they might get from the system and try and reverse engineer, that matters more than the overall design. It's the components that matter more.
Well, my earlier question, though, Peter Singer, was given that my understanding is that stealth, the B-2, for example, the flying wing design is not easy to fly. And the B-2 apparently has very complicated algorithms that keeps the plane aloft and stable. And I would think that an unmanned version of the same kind of plane or design would require complicated electronics to keep it stable. So that's what's puzzling, is how did this thing end up in fairly good shape? It certainly didn't crash, and it may have glided in or something, but my understanding is that it's a difficult plane to control at the best of times. Is that right?
That describes older systems. We're not the only ones who figured out how to fly that kind of basic design, that is a tailless plane that has a rough delta design. There's a number of other nations out there that have played at that. It's obviously, there's not as much of a history at it as the you know, more traditional airplane design, but it's we're not the only ones to pull it off. You know, that's not the key issue that they'll take away from this. Again, we don't know type of crash that it had. It could have been anything from a controlled crash, if they were able to co-opt the system, it might have, you know, gone into what we call like a flat spin, which would have explained why, you know, certain areas were damaged. I mean, we could speculate all day.
Sure.
We could speculate all day on it. I think, you know, that some of the key takeaways here are, not such a big deal for Iran other than propaganda. For other nations, maybe it helps jumpstart some of the ongoing research that they have in stealthy systems like this. To one of the final interesting takeaways to me is how this is not a crisis. That is, we focus on the fact that it's a drone, but we've missed the part of the story that because it's a drone, right now we just have pictures of a machine sitting in Iran, not an American pilot's body or a live American pilot being shown on Iranian TV. Imagine how this story would be different right now if that was the case. It would be a replay of the U-2 Gary Powers incident from back in the Cold War. This would be not just newsworthy, it would be an international crisis right now. Instead, it's not a crisis. You know, we've lost the system. Yeah, it's a loss, but it doesn't mean that tensions have been ramped up to the level where, you know, we're demanding our boy back or we're demanding the body back. I mean, it's a fundamentally different discourse. And so that explains in part the appeal of unmanned systems to policymakers, because the political consequences of something going wrong are much, much different. And so that's why, you know, people have asked me, well, because of the loss of the system, does that mean we're not going to do this in the future? And my answer is no. You know, in the future, we're going to want to continue to spy on other nations, including Iran. That's just a reality. That isn't changed. And we aren't now going to want to, for some reason, stop using drones and start using manned planes to do it. Because if we had have a manned plane do this, if it had been shot down or if it had accidentally crashed, this would be a much, much different story.
The point of my asking that question, though, Peter, is to do with the condition it's in is to try and verify or refute the Iranian claim that somehow they hacked into it and were able to bring it down. If that were the case, surely that has tremendous implications, because if you can get into the guidance system of these remote vehicles, doesn't it render the entire program in dubious circumstances?
One, we don't know if that was the case, and there's a difference between jamming and hacking. It's a difference between sort of me screaming so loudly that you can't hear to me getting inside your head and knowing what you're thinking and changing your thoughts, to give a very sort of a very poor comparison, but I'm just trying to give you that. To, again, someone able to, let's just say, hack one system, let's take it to the, you know, if they were able to pull that off, doesn't put the whole system under doubt. It's a lot like saying, well, my computer got hacked, therefore I will never use electronics ever again. We don't react that way, and we don't hear. Heck, the Predator systems a couple years ago, Iranian-supported insurgents figured out how to hack into the video feed of them. It was a gain for them. We fixed it, and we still are using Predators today. So if this was some kind of vulnerability in the system that was exploited, the answer is either to stop using the system completely, but go back to what I was saying before, we're not going to stop using them. The demand's too much. So the alternative is fix that vulnerability.
So it wouldn't then follow, for example, the Chinese, and you've suggested in an article you wrote at Brookings pointing out that the Serbs sold off parts of the crash F-117 stealth fighter during the 1990s, and that the U.S. stealth helicopter that was lost in the bin Laden raid, apparently Pakistan handed some of that over to China. Would it be possible that since China and Russia have an investment in countermeasures against the U.S.'s highest tech advances, that somehow or other they're already involved?
You know, my joke on this is that the airline flights between Moscow and Beijing to Tehran this week were probably very full.
Yes.
So, yeah, there's clearly... the Iranians have something that is of value, and more of value to nations with larger aerospace industries like China or Russia than to them. So, you know, that is most likely what will happen. But I think that parallel of the F-117 stealth fighter being lost during the operations against Serbia in the 90s is a good illustration of this. We lost... So the plane, parts of it, you know, left Serbia and were thought to have ended up in nations like Russia and China. That doesn't mean, though, that we said, well, gosh, stealth is done for. We're never going to use anything stealthy again. They created countermeasures. It helped inform their research, but we also continued ours to go on to the next generation. And that's probably the same that will happen here.
So just in closing then, Peter Singer, I guess the one thing we can say without speculating is that the Iranians are not going to heed President Obama's request for them to hand back the
Yeah. It is, the season for giving. I don't know if it's the season for giving back. I frankly don't know why they even made that request. I don't know what they expected. We didn't gain anything from making it propaganda-wise. We certainly didn't expect them to give it back. I really don't know, you know, why we even went through the motions on that one. So they've already said they're not giving it back. Don't expect that to happen anytime soon.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Peter Singer.
All right, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Singer, who's a senior fellow and director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution. He served as coordinator of the Obama 08 campaign's Defense Policy Task Force and as a consultant for the U.S. Department of Defense and the FBI. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.